So before I begin my talk, I wanted to share with you all a message from the cosmos, which I received this morning. Perhaps the previous speaker would be so kind as to read the letters here on this cup.
NFL.
It turns out that for the experimentalists among us that we've been really wasting our effort all these years. You can get NFLs here at the Coffee Bean on Calle Real in Santa Barbara. So in fact, it tastes remarkably like coffee, as it turns out. So in any case, on to more serious things. Thank you, Andy, very much for your introduction. I'm going to tell you today about some work that we've been doing on the quantum critical point, which is enabled by niobium doping in the itinerant ferromagnet zirconium zinc 2. This is work that I've done with my postdoc, Dmitry Sokolov, at the University of Michigan, using samples that we made during a visit to Zach Fisk's lab in Tallahassee. And Jeff Lin and Boulam Hamuda are our collaborators for the neutron scattering part of this project. So we're taking a brief hiatus, if you like, from the more complicated heavy fermion materials, where there's this complicated interplay of localized and extended magnetic modes. And the hope was that for zirconium zinc 2, at least the question itself would be simpler, as we believe that this is an itinerant ferromagnet. So it has an appealing symmetry. It forms in the cubic lavas phase structure, which is shown at the left. And perhaps the most dramatic demonstration, or perhaps the most direct demonstration that this is an itinerant magnet comes actually from neutron scattering measurements. If you look at the form factor, you can see that the moment, which is derived from d orbitals originating with the zirconium, actually falls off relatively slowly as you move away from the zirconium sites. And that's a graphic demonstration that the magnetization density is really more uniform than for a local moment system. So there's some question, I think, also about what the Curie temperature is in pure zirconium zinc 2. And one way that you can try to measure this is to use a low field measurement. What we've done here is to use AC susceptibility measurements in a small measuring field. On the left, I have the real part of the susceptibility, and you can actually the inverse of that. And you can see that this drops linearly with respect to temperature. And this is true, by the way, up to almost 100 degrees, although I don't show you the full run of the data. And 1 over chi disappears around 23 or 24 degrees. At the same time, you can look at the imaginary part of the susceptibility. You see that there's a sharp peak at a similar temperature. And so you might construe from these data that the Curie temperature for zirconium zinc 2 is around 23 or 24 degrees. If there's some hesitation in my delivery, it's because actually determining the Curie temperature of a ferromagnet, particularly one with a small moment, is of course difficult. And getting quantitative information, such as temperature dependences of the susceptibility in low field, is notoriously difficult. There are domain effects. And as we've also heard, if there are questions about whether or not the transition is first or second order, you have to be very careful in your procedures. There are several experimental remedies to this situation. And I guess the first and most natural is to try a different experiment, which is definitely zero field, which will help you determine when the spontaneous moment actually is present. We chose to do small angle neutron scattering measurements. We used a polycrystalline sample, and the experiments were carried out on the NG3 SANS machine at NIST. And here are some examples of our results. So I would remind you in a small angle experiment that the intensity is measured as a function of wave vector, and there's no energy discrimination in this experiment. And we'd expect that the signal has two parts. First is that there should be a wave vector dependent part, which is essentially reflecting the metallurgical structure of the sample. It should be temperature independent. In a material such as zirconium zinc 2, which is magnetic, we would expect that as we approach the critical point, that the magnetic fluctuations would give us texture that we could scatter neutrons from. And this would give us a magnetic part of the scattering, which would be strongly temperature dependent. So we've isolated the magnetic part of the signal by subtracting the intensity at high temperature from the measured intensity. And that's the quantity which I've plotted here. We find that we can describe the magnetic part of the intensity using the Guinier expression here, which has a parameter, R sub G, which basically tells us that the scattering here is from static magnetized regions in the sample. And you can see from the plot here that the expression that we've used is a reasonable description of the data. It's a radius of gyration, and so it depends on the shape of the domain, but if it were spherical, then it would be the radius of that. So we've looked at these two parameters as a function of temperature, and they're plotted here at the top of the page. The first thing we find is that that length scale is pretty well temperature independent. And so this tells us then that as we lower the temperature from 100 degrees, we see an increase in the intensity of the scattering, and that must be because we're getting more and more of these little regimes of size RG. We can see that there's a saturation of the scattered intensity, and that is a suggestion that we're at or near the Curie temperature, and put that together with the temperature independence of RG suggests that the transition, which is near 30 degrees or so, is in fact a percolative sort of transition. It's driven by the number and not by the size of these magnetized regimes. This drop in the intensity tells us for sure that we're below the Curie temperature. The sample is becoming magnetically homogeneous since it's ordered, and the small angle scattering consequently would be expected to drop. This last feature is a bit surprising, although it's also the increase in the intensity at the lowest temperatures is perhaps surprising, but I would point out that it's also been observed in other quantum critical ferromagnets, and in that case it's been ascribed to an anomalous softening of spin waves below the transition temperature. Of course, another possibility is that there is some additional organization of these domains within the ferromagnetic state. And I would have to say that at the moment, we're agnostic between those two options.
Megan, may I interrupt?
You may.
Where did you get these samples? How did you characterize them? It seemed to be very, very critical when you're getting into these homogeneities to give us some discussion as to the sample fabrication and its characterization.
I'd be delighted to.
Excellent samples.
Of course they are. The samples were made by high-temperature, high-pressure solid-state reaction. They were studied using a combination of microprobe as well as X-rays to determine that they were standard zirconium zinc 2. Let's see. So your question. There's only one point. There was only one point about your question, I think, that I have to take exception to. These inhomogeneities are magnetic inhomogeneities. Okay. Even if you were to do a SANS experiment on a crystal, you would still expect to see some small angle scattering, which would have to do with imperfections within the sample itself. This is on top of that metallurgical scattering. This is magnetic scattering.
Sure. Okay. But mosaic spread, these are single crystals, right?
These are not single crystals. These are polycrystalline samples. And so we represent the metallurgical scattering by taking the high temperature scattering, and whatever is left over, which develops as a function of temperature, this stuff is magnetic. Okay? Bill?
In the picture showing the intensity versus Q squared, there was a narrow Q center and then a broader Q before anything about the Q.
This is a very knowledgeable question. I guess another way to say it is that this is not a function which has a minimum, but the data do. This is a fine point. There are actually two things. We don't actually subtract the raw intensity because there are actually contrast changes which happen as you approach the magnetic state. And so, in fact, the origin of the minimum comes from the background subtraction procedure. So the form of the background is the same. It's just the relative contrast between the magnetic region and the background changes as a function of temperature, and that's the origin of the minimum. I should have thought so, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, you mean at high temperature? No.
Well, let's take
Okay.
What differentiates this forward angle scattering from ordinary curvature?
The only difference would be the actual form of this expression. I would say in iron, for instance, one would perhaps find a Lorentzian kind of expression with a correlation length which grows as you lower the temperature. And that's not the case here. As I argued, here we have more of a percolative picture of the phase transition. There's no evidence for a diverging length scale. And this is also, I would say that this is, in fact, closer to the sort of scattering that you'd find in not a system like nickel palladium, but maybe iron chromium or iron nickel, something like that.
Your next few graphs shows that something really interesting is happening about 80 degrees, where your correlation length is temperature independent, but the intensity is rising. Mm-hmm. To the left. Mm-hmm. Do you see something in magnetization measurement or thermodynamic measurement? Mm-hmm.
Up to about 100 degrees, the susceptibility, as I'll show you, looks like 1 over the reduced temperature. But it becomes less temperature dependent above 100 degrees.
Paul? This might be hard to answer, but are you making any statement whether you think these are static or dynamic?
All I know, the SANS experiment collects neutrons which are both elastically scattered and inelastically scattered. So we have no discrimination as a function of energy. But I would say that one of the standard explanations for this increase at low temperature is that there's changes in the inelastic scattering. Okay, so I must move on. Okay, so zirconium zinc 2 then according to this zero field measurement, seems to, in fact, order below 30 degrees or so. However, given these complications, it's, I think, traditional to try to go a simpler route, and in view of what Andy talked about in his introduction, I would cast this in a slightly different way. That is, we know that there are very complicated behaviors that are possible in low field in zirconium zinc 2, and so we've decided to characterize the high field phase. And so the error plot is a way in which we can do that, and I will just briefly run through the pieces of information that you can get from this analysis. The error plot is based on, again, the equation of state expression, which I've had here, which I show here. And to the extent that the error plot, that is the plot of m squared versus h over m, is linear, it suggests that this is a sufficient explanation. These are sufficient number of terms in this equation of state. So here, for instance, are these data for zirconium zinc 2. And I should point out to you that what we're trying to do is extrapolate the low field behavior from high field measurements. And these measurements range from 0.5 Tesla up to about 5 Tesla. So we're looking at high field data. So the first thing that you can determine, of course, from data of this sort is that in the limit that the field goes to zero, you can have a magnetization. That would be called the spontaneous moment. And we can look at this vertical intercept as a function of temperature. Here it is. You can see that it has a nice mean field behavior and suggests that there's a transition at about 17 degrees, which is quite different from what the low field measurements predicted. The other piece of information that comes from this error plot analysis is the converse. It's the intercept on the horizontal axis. This is the value of h over m and the limit that m squared goes to zero. It is called the initial susceptibility, or rather 1 over the initial susceptibility. So we've looked again at the temperature dependence of this intercept. Here it is. You can see that it increases linearly as a function of temperature and vanishes near about 17 degrees as well. So again, we find essentially a mean field kind of expression for this susceptibility. So, shall I rephrase? Shall I just say we find that gamma is 1? These data suggest that gamma is 1. And I think that the closest we come is 17 degrees, so we have not made a special study incredibly close to the putative transition. So of course we were inspired to try to find a quantum critical point. Given our experimental interest, we were interested in doing this not with the use of pressure, but rather with the use of compositional substitution. And I would show you here some older data on zirconium zinc 2. These are susceptibility measurements under pressure, which suggest that there is, in fact, a critical pressure for these experiments, about 8 kilobars. And at least at that stage of refinement, these were thought to be second-order transitions, but as we saw, that is apparently not the case for higher quality samples. So we set out to suppress the ferromagnetism in zirconium zinc 2 by doping with niobium, and here are some examples of our results. I should say that all the moments and all the susceptibilities, which I'm going to show you in the rest of the talk, came from error plot analyses. These are not direct measurements of these quantities. Here I show you the spontaneous moment as a function of temperature for compositions from pure zirconium zinc 2 up to 6% niobium. You can see that at each composition, we still get the mean field sort of behavior, but that the effect of niobium doping is to suppress TC and to suppress the spontaneous moment simultaneously. So what I've done in this plot I've plotted the transition temperature, which you get from those mean field expressions. These are the blue points. There's another one, of course, underneath this red point. And this shows you, in fact, that TC vanishes in the neighborhood of 8% niobium. This is not a particularly straight line, but just for fun, I plotted TC to the power 4/3. These would be the red data, and you can see that you get a much more satisfactory shot at a straight line. And this, of course, is the exponent that you would have expected from the mean field quantum ferromagnet.
What is K?
What is K? Kelvins or Kelvin to the four, those are units, TC and TC to the 4/3. And the critical concentration that we get is about 8.5%. What is N? N is 1. That's okay. I like the questions I can answer. I think it's interesting to compare the actual effect of niobium doping on both TC and the spontaneous moment at zero temperature, which I've done in these two panels, and you can see it's remarkably similar. This suggests, in fact, that if you were to plot the spontaneous moment versus TC, that they should be linearly related, and in fact, they do seem to be. This is exactly what one would expect for a stoner ferromagnet enhanced with magnetic fluctuations. Not that you had any doubt that this was an itinerant ferromagnet. So I'd like to turn the discussion now to the initial susceptibility. This is to the initial susceptibility, otherwise the derivative of the magnetization with respect to field and the limit of zero field. These data are reproduced here as a function of temperature for all the different compositions that we've studied. So let me begin by considering the range of compositions for which ferromagnetism is possible.
I beg your pardon? It's like adding this order to doping?
Putting in the niobium? Of course, that's a possibility.
Isn't it a probability?
I can't say if it's a possibility or a probability, Paul.
Well, you're changing the band.
Indeed. That's true. They're not isoelectronic either.
That's right.
Why not? I like to. Anyway, there's never a question that you introduce disorder with doping. The question, I think, the harder question to answer is, what's the relevance of that disorder? Does it qualitatively change the physics of the system? And that's tougher to answer experimentally. So let me first start by considering the range of niobium concentrations for which ferromagnetism is possible. So here's 1 over the susceptibility. Great. And you can see that the susceptibility, 1 over chi, actually vanishes only at a finite temperature, that's TC, and TC marches down with niobium, as I've suggested. The black data are 8%, and you can see that here TC must be very low. Here this must be very low. So let's now look at the complementary range of niobiums, here where no ferromagnetism is possible, that's at 9, 12, and 14%. You can see something quite different here, specifically that for the first time at zero temperature, there's no possibility that the susceptibility diverges. And finally, I'd like to highlight the importance of the critical concentration, which apparently lies somewhere between the black and the yellow data. For here, we actually have the divergence of the susceptibility at zero temperature. So in my remaining 30 seconds, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the susceptibility in the paramagnetic phase. And those data are reproduced here. So we're talking about this range of concentrations. We've modeled the data here in terms of this expression, specifically that there is a finite susceptibility in zero temperature, and that over the remainder of the temperatures, we have a power law dependence. And so what I'd like to do is look a little bit into what that power law really could be. So we begin by asking a simple question. We know in zirconium zinc 2 that at high temperatures, the susceptibility looks like 1 over the temperature. And the question then would be, is there a range of temperatures, even in the paramagnetic phase, where the susceptibility also goes like 1 over T? And of course, the answer is yes. This is a plot of 1 over chi. It's been normalized just so that we can compare all three of these compositions simultaneously. And what we find is, in fact, at high temperature, that we do find a 1 over T dependence for the susceptibility. That temperature is 55 degrees at 8%, 45 degrees, 9%, 30 degrees at 12%, about 5 degrees at 14%. So in this whole blue region, one finds 1 over T susceptibility. So this is the form of the susceptibility. I just chose the names of my parameters just for fun, because it looks very much like a Curie-Weiss law. Of course, I absolutely want to stress there's no evidence at all for localized moments. But nonetheless, it's interesting to look how these parameters develop with doping. I turn the Curie constant, into an effective moment, which is plotted here as a function of niobium concentration. And as Andy pointed out, this is much, much larger than the spontaneous moment, but drops off very quickly when one leaves the ferromagnetic phase. The next thing I'd like to discuss is what happens in this range of temperatures. And perhaps you'd not be surprised to know that here we find power law behavior. For instance, and so that's shown here. This is the expression that fits our data. And so what we want to do is isolate this T to the gamma term, which we do by subtracting the zero field susceptibility and multiplying through by C. And you can see that on this log-log plot that we get a larger power law for the 9% data, which is close to the critical point, and a smaller exponent for 14%, which is relatively far from the critical point. So our conclusion then is there's a little region of temperatures and concentrations near the critical concentration for which we see a more divergent response, and particularly that the susceptibility is in fact most divergent right near the quantum critical point. So in fact, we've studied this exponent more carefully at the different compositions. And in the ordered phase, we find little evidence that gamma is very much different from 1. On the other hand, if we look in the paramagnetic range over here, we find that at least at low temperatures, that gamma is substantially elevated, particularly near the critical point, but reverts back to 1 as we move away from the critical point. And finally, at the critical concentration, the susceptibility really does diverge at zero temperature, and the exponent that with which that happens is the 4/3, which is predicted for a mean field quantum critical three-dimensional ferromagnet. I should also single out the Griffiths phase for special attention here. You might be concerned about the non-universality of this exponent as being a disorder effect, but I think that a simple explanation in terms of the Griffiths phase will not be effective here. And the argument there is that if the parent phase is pure zirconium zinc 2, there's no way to get a larger exponent than the exponent for zirconium zinc 2, which is 1. So I wanted to finish my talk just by showing you how the various parameters which describe the susceptibility are modified by changing the doping level. If we are in the ferromagnetic phase, of course, the scale for the susceptibility is this quantity chi naught, and it's plotted as the blue squares here. It increases strongly as you approach the critical point, but is otherwise relatively independent of concentration in the ferromagnetic phase. Conversely, if we look in the paramagnetic part of the phase diagram, the susceptibility is given by this expression. So the zero temperature susceptibility is C over theta. This quantity is shown as the red squares, also increases strongly as you approach the critical concentration from above. So this suggests that the zero temperature susceptibility, this is the equivalent, I guess, of a field sweep in a sense. The susceptibility really does seem to diverge at the critical concentration, or at least gets very large. The last point I'd like to make is that while TC, in fact, is suppressed, as far as we can tell, continuously to zero at about 8%, there's an additional energy scale in this problem, which is theta. That also seems to decrease and perhaps vanish at the critical concentration. This is eerie. So in a sense, theta is something which just tells you how far from the critical point you really are, not unlike the generalized Curie-Weiss expression, which was evoked in, for instance, cerium copper 6 doped with gold. So as I'm over my time, I would just like to put up my conclusions. Specifically, that niobium doping in zirconium zinc 2 does generate a quantum critical point, which is apparently continuous at 8.5%, but that this is a critical point which is deduced from high field data. The properties of this high field phase are manifestly mean field-like, but in the paramagnetic phase, we see evidence for a characteristic temperature scale, which goes to zero at the critical concentration, which is marked by a divergence of the susceptibility. Thank you very much. Professor Stewart.
Not necessarily an attack question, but really for interest, sort of going along with John Lydon's question earlier. Mm-hmm. Do you know residual resistivity versus niobium concentration?
No, these are polycrystalline samples.
Mm-hmm.
It is a fantastic. It's a fantastic question for a variety of reasons. Yes, we've done some measurements at low fields of the magnetization, and I showed you some of the results. So the question really is, whether or not the differences that we see between these data and the low field are because of the field, or are they because of the doping? And I would answer the question in the following way, which is that we've also done neutron scattering on more concentrated samples. And we believe that the critical point in zero field really is about 5% niobium, and that it's first order from the neutron scattering. We don't have a detailed study of the low field measurements. So my bias would be that the more pertinent problem with these data, feature of these data, would be that they're high field data. And that's the primary difference from the low field data. We haven't measured the resistivity. Thank you, John. We do not have the resistivity, so please don't ask me any more questions about what the resistivity does, Paul. It would be just some sense of it, because of course the intergranular scattering would play some role as well.
The main question though is, if you look at your size of the moments, mm-hmm. you have your effective moment much larger than your saturated you also have, this is high field data, you have these clusters or areas. Can't you just analyze this in terms of super paramagnetism? If this correlates to your cluster size that you were extracting earlier, that would seem to be a very nice self-consistency and probably
In fact, the susceptibility really doesn't give any indication of superparamagnetism or some dynamical freezing at a particular temperature. I would also really object to the sort of use of the word cluster. There are no local moments in this system. The magnetized regions that we're scattering from in the neutron scattering are critical fluctuations.
Sure.
That's a, or
fine.
You want to call that a cluster?
Well, no, I'm on the cluster. But the superparamagnetism, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So can you analyze it?
As I said, the susceptibility, the field-cooled, zero-field-cooled hysteresis that you would ordinarily see in a superparamagnetic state is, there's really not any basis for that kind of an analysis here. There's not a strong hysteresis between the field-cooled and the zero-field-cooled, nor is there any evidence of a freezing temperature from the susceptibility as you would need for superparamagnetism.
Well, that's
These are compositions which order. Hilbert.
A very soft paramagnet that you always have a difference between zero field cool and field cool susceptibility. So it's very important to look at.
I'm not denying that there is such a hysteresis, and we have certainly seen evidence for it at larger niobium concentrations, which are near what we believe is the zero field critical concentration. That is absolutely the case. But but obviously that's a low field attribute.
When we last worked on this system 40 years ago, we considered it to be a soft ferromagnet.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have shown very intriguing data in one of your first slides here, mm-hmm. that the AC susceptibility, imaginary part, has mm-hmm. all the dissipation in it.
Mm-hmm.
And this would indicate a certain type of irreversibility. The thing is not a homogeneous soft ferromagnet. It's developing out of a bunch of clusters which mm-hmm. are irreversible. There's mm-hmm. hysteresis, there's heat loss into this thing.
Well, even for a single crystal of iron, you would have hysteresis. Even in a single crystal of iron, you would have hysteresis from the domains. So it's
that's a good hysteretic ferromagnet. But this system was classified as a very soft ferromagnet. That's
yes.
one of the criteria.
Absolutely.
Of the itinerancy.
Absolutely.
Susceptibility went up mm-hmm. and became a plateau. It did not show domains or clusters. But now it looks like in this very narrow region, you're getting the domains, and usually you use the word magnetic percolation.
Yes.
Right? And that's a nice second order phase transition.
Mm-hmm.
Percolated can be fit into it. But
I don't
get out with a small angle neutron scattering. Previously, these were not found.
I guess I don't disagree with anything that you say.
You said there were ghosts.
I've already dealt. Well, he's stuck with local moments. What can I say?
Maybe my question is along the same global direction. I'm slightly puzzled about the picture that you're developing. In the first part, when you talk about the pure supercondensing,
right?
Didn't you make the argument that the magnetic correlation does not really diverge, but stays somehow finite or and then there's something perturbative about the transition?
Correct.
If you take that at face value, then why would you expect these four surface exponents, among other things, which come out of a third theory, of course, is a diverging correlation length and then diverging magnetic fluctuations. I don't see that we can fit together somehow.
Well, I guess I have to ask you if you're questioning my data. I mean, the sands definitely tells you that you have a non-diverging length, that it's a percolative sort of process, and at the same time, we measure the phase line and we measure the susceptibility, and we get those exponents. So perhaps it suggests there's more than one route to those exponents.
Yeah, I guess the same question, how certain you are that that actually goes to zero?
That what goes to zero?
That theta goes to zero?
As you, I'll just show you what the facts are. We have it at these three concentrations, and so there you are. And it's definitely zero, by the way, at 8%, of course, because you have an actual diverging susceptibility there. So it goes to zero somewhere between this composite 9% and 8%.
In this sense, are you integrating over a wide energy region, or is it static?
You're integrating over a wide range of energies.
Okay, that might be some of
the
mm-hmm.
subsequent
Yes, and there's already, I think, the belief, as I mentioned, that there are changes in the inelastic spectrum also when you drop below TC, which could pump more weight down into the low angles. And so that's, of course, a fine question. Dr. Byers. Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Okay. Thanks very much.